Okay, well, Richard, thank you for joining us. Would you like to start by explaining what it is that you do?
So I'm the Director of e-Research at the University of Melbourne, and I'm a Professor of Applied Computing Systems. And I am involved in many different projects, and most of my work is involving building software for researchers. So most academic organizations, or organizations more generally, they are very good at doing generic things, so giving you a laptop or fixing your printer and things of that nature. They're not very good at building you a cancer database or processing terabytes of data for a specific researcher. So my role around the university is to do those kind of things. I'm involved in many projects, from the arts and humanities to zoology. Nearly all of my projects are data-driven, so it's heterogeneous data, many different type of researchers who have different needs and demands on access to and use of data, and that pretty much drives what I do. I have a team of about 30 software engineers who are funded on a range of projects, from US intelligence to defense to NHMRC to European monies, etc. And we build a track record of delivering software that people seem to use. So that's kind of my role. I'm involved in lots of projects supporting many researchers concurrently.
And when you say you're dealing with heterogeneous data, what does that mean? What does it look like?
There are many, sure, no, there are, it's a good question. There are many different application domains which need access to data. I can give you so many different examples. I'll give you a simple one. Let's say diabetes. Most hospitals are treating patients with diabetes. You would think, therefore, that there should be a way for them to share that data on patients with diabetes, and they all understand the data that's being collected. In reality, most hospitals are collecting slightly different data. It's coded differently. So you might code diabetes a certain way, or you might measure insulin a different way and how they're being treated, etc. And that's common. So most sites who are treating patients are collecting what they think is the correct data. It can be ad hoc. It can be sitting in a different type of sort of database. It can be in spreadsheets. It can be all kinds of different sort of technologies they're using. And so most of my work is trying to building systems which makes it all look like it's the same, even though it's actually coded differently. So if you imagine male or female, that could be M or F, true or false, one or zero. As a trivial example, somewhere along the line, someone has to be able to say how many women or how many men, and understanding the differences in the data models of all the different sites and how we can actually integrate that data. And that gets fairly complicated fairly quickly. But the variety of the data is one of the major issues that face many researchers right now.
So while we're in an era where everyone's collecting a lot of information,
mm-hmm.
we're not at the point where we can share that or make judgments about the whole.
You can, I guess this is why I get so many projects. So there is a technical aspect of doing this. How do you build a technology that can get data from different hospitals or wherever it might be from? And then there is the process of dealing with the various agencies or hospitals or government organizations that actually have the data. So there's no use having all this clever technology if you're not allowed to talk across their firewall. So it's about how do we do that? How do we, this is something I don't have a silver bullet for. I can certainly build the tech. I can't always make someone do what I want in terms of allowing me access to the kind of resources that, and sometimes that's for a very good reason. If it's patient data, not anyone should just be able to go and grab that data, obviously. But there are other data sets which are less sensitive, where you would think it should be more possible to access this, and why can't we? But again, there are many sort of hurdles in the way a lot of the time in doing that, and they differ every time. I guess one of the lessons I've learned in doing this, a lot of the time when you have this conversation with a data provider, the standing scenario or where they start from typically is you don't get fired by not giving away the data. So there has to be a really good reason for them to do this. Either an edict from on high, you will, or it's in their interest to share the data and there's some benefit that they will derive. And finding those carrots or sticks is part of the work of how do we work with these folks who sit on this data.
Mm-hmm. So in part it's about system solutions, but also it's about a philosophy.
It's about relationships. I guess at the end of the day, it's trust. So I didn't really talk so much about the projects I'm involved in, but I run lots of very sensitive security-oriented projects. So I'm involved in many clinical trials and disease registries and biobanks. I work with lots of hospitals. I work with data from, previously when I was based in the UK, I worked with the Oxford English Dictionary on access to their resources. I work with Intel and ARM on computer chip designs. I've worked in many areas where there is either some sensitivity around the data, some commercial intellectual property around, you know, the systems, etc. And it's about working with those folks to allow access under their terms and conditions. Because I can't say, open up your firewall, I need to suck out your data, because they're going to say no. And I can't even say, install all this technology on your system so as I can talk to you. They'll say no. So we have to be able to work with whatever's already in place. And sometimes what's in place is actually, you know, less than optimal, I guess you could say. There's systems which are should be upgraded, but they haven't for whatever reason. And that's not uncommon as well. So a lot of the time, the feedback and the interactions when you have trying to get access to the data is, we'll do that, but in due course, once we've installed all our enterprise systems, which will be ready in 2020, that's kind of another sort of scenario that happens. We're willing to do it, but we're not quite resourced to do it yet. But watch this space. That happens a lot too.
So it's not a priority?
I guess when the rubber hits the road, no. The voice from on high is open data. It shall happen. It's a good thing. We all want this. But the actual practical realities a lot of the time is to actually really make open data open is more than just sticking it on a website. People do stick data on the websites. I mean, if you want to know about the population statistics of Australia, you go to the ABS. They've got thousands and thousands of spreadsheets you can download. But the problem there is that there's so much independent individual data sets that you end up, you like download to try and get the thing you're interested in. And what you really want to have is a way to programmatically access that data, where you're not just getting it off a website, but you can talk to their databases and ask questions of their data. And then you get targeted information back, which means that you don't have to download 10,000 spreadsheets. That's kind of a lot of the open data solutions right now are in that sort of, we'll put our data on the website as a, you can download it as an Excel spreadsheet or a PDF document or some other format. But that's kind of one way of delivering a solution. But the reality there is that it's very difficult now to integrate all of those data from different organizations when they have, you know, ad hoc solutions for how to deliver their data to the external customers.
So what is the philosophy behind open data?
It means many things to many people. So for some people, it's all data should be accessible. If you're collecting data on me, I should have access to it. But there are many layers of gray in that. I mean, there are many areas where you should not have access to data. So I should not be able to tell you, you know, what disease does my next door neighbor have and when did they get diagnosed? You know, that's not my business. I should not allow access to that. And so there are shades of gray. Open doesn't always mean open on the internet for everyone to access. There are many resources available right now which are open. You know, we can pull out data, which is, you can tell things that you should not be allowed to tell. And this is pretty straightforward. So for example, social media, I do a huge amount of work with social media. And we've done many things which are pushing the boundaries of, we really shouldn't be allowed to do this, but we can. I mean, the technology allows you. So I'm slightly wary of the camera, but I'll tell you, you can edit this out later on if you want to. But I had one student interested in human trafficking. And so I thought, no one's going to tweet about this or post things like this. So we ended up looking at the sex industry in Melbourne. So from social media, you can identify brothels and massage parlors and things like this. You can identify the buildings where they go, where they are. And then you can say, who's ever used social media in that building? And even if it's most innocuous, you know, I'm running late, dear, I'll see you later. So these are really the danger. And this data now, these people would never have made that available if they would have known how much that little 140 character tweet was actually 9 kilobytes of data, telling us all the things they probably have no idea about. So when I teach cloud computing, we do a lot of work on, not so much on the sex industry, but on how you can combine data sets. So social media data, data from government, data from industry, and explore patterns of behavior, commuting patterns of people around Melbourne, for example. should you go on the train or the bus, health and pandemics, you know, where is the recent flu outbreak, where did that start, who was the first person that was infected according to social media, and how does that correlate with the GPs that are recording flu outbreaks in various areas. So sometimes you want it for a good reason, national. If the zombie virus ever comes, we want to be able to track and see what. But there's other times where you really don't want to be doing this. You shouldn't be allowed to do it. But it's quite easy to do it from a technical side.
So a lot of that is already available. You could just start harvesting that information.
It is. So a lot of these sort of commercial companies like Twitter and Instagram and Flickr and Foursquare, they're collecting data all the time, and they use it for business. So they're marketing and Facebooks of this world. That's how they make all the revenue. And so they're profiling people. You know, if I like a certain thing, then I might be interested in buying these products. And that's kind of what a lot of the Googles and the Facebooks do. And they actually offer you ways for you to access that data. So some do, some don't. They're not all standardized. So we can certainly access Twitter data. So you can write some software which will connect to Twitter and pull out tweets in Melbourne, for example. And you can then start tracking people. And then you can start looking at where do you buy your clothes, or where do you go to eat, drink your coffees. Or it's very easy to do this. And then we can, not just for you, we can then find who do you follow and who follows you. And we can start building up your network about how you interact with people in virtual space and how does that relate to the real space. So, and a lot of these commercial providers or social media platforms provide access for anyone to suck out the data. And that's kind of what we do. So this is not as though we have to apply for ethics to do this. It's actually interesting, at the University of Melbourne, they're saying before you process anyone's data, you have to get permission from them. So I've got 100 million tweets. Who do I ask? It's not good. I mean, there's already people are using this for all kinds of things. And it's this kind of, I guess this is one of the challenges with open data, is that there's data that people are probably unaware of the consequences of how easy it is to combine seemingly innocuous data for arbitrary purposes, which people had no idea of. And we do lots and lots of work in this space. So we can identify traffic jams in the city before Vic Roads. You know, we can identify a cluster of tweets in space and time on the road is a traffic jam. And we can tell you which route to go. And we combine that with other data, let's say pollution data. So you shouldn't go this way because there's lots of cars. There's going to be higher pollution. Go this route instead. So we do lots of these kind of mashing up data. Sometimes it's, you know, for good, obviously. But it's very easy to example there again is an interesting one, because you're not supposed to tweet on the roads. And we know people who tweet all the time on CityLink or on Westgate Bridge. Again, you can use this data, but you shouldn't really be doing that if you are on the roads, and that's kind of illegal. But where do you draw the lines of what can we do with this data? So this is kind of, it's a very highly evolving space where there's lots of data being produced all around us. And there's people like myself who know how to build software to bring it together, to tell stories. But there is no cohesive governance across most of this. It's a little bit ad hoc, I'd say, certainly in the social media space and linking it with other data sets.
So if you were to explain to a layperson, what do we mean when we say we're now in the era of big data? What does that mean?
So for the many people, they think big equals volume, the size. So you have a gigabyte, a terabyte, an exabyte, there's large amounts of data. And for many people, that's the problem they face. So if you're a physicist at the Large Hadron Collider, or you're an astrophysicist at the Square Kilometer Array, they have petabytes of data they generate. And then they have to process that data. So that, for many people, is what they mean by big data. But there is a mixture of interpretation. So I guess one way is to describe it. If it doesn't fit on your computer, it's big. That's a trivial example. But actually, one of the real issues is the speed of production of the data, the velocity of its production. So if I had every car in Victoria with a sensor sending data. I am here, I am here, I am here every second. That's going to also one of the real challenges of dealing with big data. So the ingestion of all the data, how fast you produce it, can you process it in time? One of the real issues, I guess, is the variety of data. And I guess most of my work on a practical level, I do have projects with huge amounts of data and high velocity data, but most of the work is really around the variety of the data. So we have these Vs, velocity, volume, variety. And that's a real the killer app, I guess. Everyone's trying to do that, trying to integrate diverse data sets, which are out of the box incomparable. So this is a spreadsheet and this is the road network, a graph. How do you compare those two things? So we do a lot of work in building software systems that allow to make those heterogeneous data sets look the same at some level. And then there's an awful lot more work going on in terms of say veracity. So the whole idea of fake news and trusting the data. So anyone can post anything on the internet. Is it true? Is it a lie? How do you disambiguate? And how do you understand what it is? How much trust do you put in the data around you? And one example of doing that, imagine someone tweets in London, I just saw a lion on the streets. Idiot. You know, someone's just joking. Three separate people in that area say, I just saw a lion. It's now becoming more believable. And to if London Zoo says, sorry, we left the gate open, it's now a fact there's a lion loose. From a completely don't believe it to it's the truth. We believe it now. There's a scale. And I guess we do a lot of work in understanding how to improve the accuracy and improve the trust we have in the data that we can see all around us. And so this is one of the problems with social media. There is no, you can tell any story you like from, you know, data that's just thrown out there, but is it right or is it wrong? Just because 10,000 people all like Mr. Trump's tweet doesn't mean say he's right. It's just the case he has a lot of people who are agreeing with that thing, but, you know, climate change, do you agree with it? You know, lots of people have very diverse opinions on this. And I guess we do a lot of work in trying to clarify how we do those kind of things. So in a nutshell, that's big data. We're living in a world where data is being produced all around us, whether directly we want it, whether it's your video camera here or whether it's your phone reception, collecting I know where you are from your GPS, and that's being sent to Optus or Telstra or whoever, and now we can geocode where you've been and where you go. And so it's really working in that world where we need the algorithms and the software infrastructure and the cloud and high performance computers to process all of this and make sense of it. Because most people can't do very much with it on their own. They need large scale resources to do a lot of the crunching of the data to tell particular research questions, answer research questions, or just things that are of interest to society as a whole, I guess. So big data is, I guess we could describe it through the Vs. Volume, velocity, variety, veracity, and there's probably a few others as well, but it means many things to many people.
What do you see are the benefits to just ordinary citizens of this sort of data revolution?
Sure.
What might we be able to achieve?
Ideally, you'd like, you know, to have a better world. I mean, you should not just be making decisions or trusting a politician to make the right decisions. You should be driven by the data. Do we need that tunnel? Do we need the hospital? Do we need that train station? Why? Rather than someone's just agreeing to it because for whatever reason. And so the transparency of how information is collected and used to make decisions for the benefit of us all is something that I think many people are interested in. And even on a completely different topic. So if you wanted to know how to treat cancer patients, you would assume, and I did before I started doing these kind of jobs, that if you have a certain type of cancer, there is a standard recipe that it works best for you, that the doctors who went to medical school, that's kind of why they went to medical school. But those recipes change all the time. And they are, you know, if you're trying to work out how many patients survive with this type of treatment in our hospital, how does that compare to all the other hospitals globally? This is something that integrating data, you know, this is, everyone wants a cure for cancer, everyone wants the best treatments. But right now it's very difficult for the doctors to determine which is the best treatment and which recipes do we follow. Is it chemotherapy and then this drug, or is it radiotherapy and then this? And which surgery seems to have the best outcome? So by aggregating lots of data like this, the doctors can start looking at, you know, long-term survival and, you know, and getting the patient's feedback into this as well. So, you know, there's many, many reasons for integrate data. It's not all just because, hey, someone can make money from it or governments should be more transparent. There are many more obvious good reasons that you want to integrate data and build up a larger scale sort of resource where you can start benchmarking. And then, okay, then in addition to that, you have things like pharmaceutical companies. We're looking for 10,000 patients who had this condition and didn't respond to that treatment. Where are they? And that's kind of running clinical trials like this. There's a lot of work in that space where we are doing, I guess it's very fragmented how these things happen right now. And it shouldn't be that way. It should be much far more. If you have a 10,000 patients with a certain type of cancer, I'm sure that if you said, would you be interested in being involved in this study which could help you, most of them would probably say yes. You know, they're interested in this. They won't, you know, they don't want others to suffer. But having that data is, you know, where do you get that? And right now we have a broken ecosystem, not just in Australia, but globally, whereby data is not being shared to the right people in the right context for the right purposes. And that's kind of one of the real problems.
So you talked a little bit about, I suppose, different domains that seem to hold the data. Is that one of the problems, that there might be a private collector here and then a government collector here? Is that one of the issues?
There are many sort of overlapping areas where it's kind of strange how, I think an example might be the housing data in Australia. You know, property auctions and houses that are being advertised and sold, and what do they get sold for, and is it underquoting or overbidding and all this kind of stuff. So that data generally belongs to the valuer generals in the various states. But for some reason, there's commercial investments or commercial sort of companies, sort of, I won't name them, but they seem to have a monopoly on collecting that data and then making it available through their websites and their web apps. And if you want to have access to that data to do your own analysis, then historically, you know, how is the housing, you know, what trends are we seeing, and where should I or shouldn't I buy, then you can't get access to that data, and which is kind of crazy. In other countries, this never happens. You know, in the UK, if you want to know about all the houses in my street, how much do they sell for, when did they sell for, you can get that data. Whereas over in Australia, that's not the case. It seems to be locked up with a few commercial companies, and they use this data for all kinds of things. They sell it to banks, they sell it to insurance companies, they're making a profit out of collecting this data.
So what do you need to put in place so you have data that's trustworthy, that's accessible, that's the expression you used before about you being able to drill down to it and ask questions that are useful for me as an end user. What are the steps that we need to do?
There are many. It depends on the domain, I guess. I do a lot of work with government agencies, and generally speaking, they have a remit, I guess you could say, to collect certain types of data, whether it's air quality data or the number of cars on the roads or whatever the thing might be. And one assumes that they are doing the best they possibly can and producing the most accurate data. It could be the census, it could be there's processes and procedures they go through to collect data, which should be as good as possible. And it just so happens that once they've done that, ideally then it should be, you know, made more directly accessible. There's always a challenge in doing that. Because you might be able to find out where someone lives, or they are the only person in that neighborhood that has this, therefore you'd be able to identify them if we made it available. But certainly I don't think it's impossible that this world where there is government agencies that are collecting data, that are making it accessible programmatically. So we've done this. I have in one of my projects, we've integrated data from 88, I think it is now, government agencies, which is integrating data from the cities. So if you want to know the correlation between happiness and access to a park, or how many children have a BMI above a certain level, and how many fast food restaurants are in that area, and how many cars do the mum and dad on average own in that area, is this causing the childhood obesity? Those kind of integrating, mashing up data, we can do that. We've done that. The systems are alive and doing that. But the problem is it's perpetually, you know, I want the data from yesterday. I don't care about the 2011 census or the data from you know, 15 years ago. I want data now that they're collecting now. And that's something that I guess many agencies struggle to achieve, you know, making it live. As soon as they've collected it, it's available. Some try. I mean, we're working with many agencies that are trying to do these things, like Vic Roads, for example. But it's still a challenge because a lot of the time they are trying to build up their own data resources to derive intelligence, to write reports to government, etc. And that's kind of where their priority is. At the same time, they're making some of the data available for academics who are interested in this stuff and writing research papers, etc. I guess if you gave access to all the data to all the public, not many people would make use a huge amount of use of it. I can't generalize there, but it's the case that there are so many data resources out there that the integration of all of these is a challenge because you're dealing with different timescales, different spatial levels. So let's say you can have local governments, you can have suburbs, you can have many different ways to describe Australia, postcodes, et cetera, and they change over time. The population profile changes over time. So if you're trying to create some sort of knowledge of what's happened here, when and why, then you're dealing with shifting sort of data sets. They evolve over time. The population of Melbourne now is way different than it was 5 years ago. The boundaries of Melbourne are changing, they're evolving. And how do we track this over time? And if someone comes along and says, is Melbourne the most livable city? You know, you might look at people are happier or sad here, but how are you benchmarking that? Are you benchmarking that against people who have got money and live in Toorak? Or are you benchmarking that people who live in Bacchus Marsh and drive into Melbourne on wherever it is on the motorway in the morning and stuck in that traffic jams all the time? So again, there are lots of sort of issues like this, which I don't think we really have a good handle for. But one thing I will say is that we have the tech. I mean, we build technology which works. Now, we've sort of, this is no longer a research topic. Can we build it? We can build it. We've built it many times. It's really just a case of how do we build it with the agencies that have the data? And that's really the trick for open data. It's not just sticking it on a website. It's building it with people who can integrate data and make that available to diverse communities.
So if you were, what would be on your wish list if you were talking to someone who was responsible for one of those agencies or responsible for government policy making around data? What would you like them to be thinking about?
There is the agencies themselves, and I guess there's part of, certainly the being able to programmatically access their data is high on the agenda. And most of the agencies now have suddenly realized that if we do this, it will save us money because we don't have to deal with all these individual email requests saying, give us access to your data. So there's a variety of things like this, which is slowly happening in many places, I guess. There is one thing, which is the killer, which is the fact that who's funding all of this stuff. So I have several projects where we've been resourced very well for the last few years to provide access to all of this distributed data. And yet the longevity and the sustainability of these projects, we've built a system now, it has 8,500 users, they're using it daily to ask all kinds of questions related to data around cities, etc. But that project has a 2-year lifetime. And it's very difficult to, you know, you'd think the governments, the Department of Innovation, now it's Education, who's funding it, the federal level, would think we have a plan. You know, we have a 10-year plan for managing all of this and leveraging what we've already proven to or has been shown to work. That's kind of the killer, because whilst the tech is really evolving very rapidly, this is one of the things. This is not like a fixed way. There's one way to manage your data and this is it. There are many recipes that Google and many others are building, and we use that. So we don't, I don't just somehow magically have the answer. We build technology all the time and we benchmark our technology and we see how fast can we do it and how performance and how much of the cloud do we need to do it to process all this data, etc. But the longevity of these projects is really the key. So you've sponsored a bunch of, not you, but the government sponsored a bunch of projects to integrate all this data. And they put a limit on, you know, you're funded to here. Ideally, you'd like to have some sort of long-term plan for how are you going to continue to do this. Because I know if there's people in my team who build a lot of this tech and they get headhunted all the time. They go to Amazon or to investment banks or what have you. And they have a range of skill sets, which if they leave, I have a few people that have been working for me for 15 years or so now, but they have skill sets that are kind of essential. There's one thing having the tech, there's actually another thing having someone who really knows this tech, because they found 17 ways to break it and improve it. And that's kind of, and the problem with the future is that I can't guarantee, all my techies are on soft money, grants, and I write lots of grants all the time to keep it all going. But that's a very fickle and fragile model, which is if the government decides they're going to do X, then suddenly I have to find other ways to generate the revenue. And that's not a good model. That's so on the data provider side, just coming back, I think following the kind of recipes that we've established of how to access data and use data, there is a degree of dependency on them still. So it's not just the case of we've got a database, you can talk to our database and our problems are solved now. Because a lot of their data means nothing to someone on the other side of the fence. So it might be a data set related to a single unemployed Aboriginal female from Adelaide. And that's coded as AAB13422X. Unless you know somehow this is what that thing means. All we now know is there's a thing, AA123, whatever it was, with 27%. You know, what does that mean? No one knows unless someone's going to provide us that metadata to describe what that thing's about, which we could then use to say, I'm interested in, you know, the population profile of Adelaide. I wonder, you know, how many single, et cetera, are available there or exist there. So this is one of the issues. So data providers have some sort of requirement to provide metadata. It's not just the case if you can talk to our database. Certainly that helps. But more often than not, you need to know more than that. Because otherwise, you're not going to be able to. How was the data collected? How was it normalized? Who collected it? What was the weather like when you were collecting it? There's a whole variety of things that can impact on that data, which someone who's using it would need to know about to make sense of it. So it's more than just give us your data. It's actually work with us to allow your data to be shareable and useful for other people in other contexts, other than, you know, I'm an expert on, you know, the indigenous population of Adelaide, and therefore I know what all these variables are. There's not many people who do that. There are many other people who are sort of, that could be very interesting to many people if they only knew it existed and how to access it. And the only way you can find it, discover it, access it, and use it is by having access to human readable metadata.
Oh, there's so many issues. That are fascinating what you just said. First of all, it seems like there's almost a community perception that we can get real-time data anytime.
Yep.
And that you're just saying, well, maybe the technology's there, but that's not what happens. So do you think there's a disconnect between what we as a community expect?
I don't think people have an awareness of how much data is being collected about them all the time anyway.
Right.
I mean, whether it's social media, you can be tagged in photographs, even you're not even involved in any of these things, but there's data all around us being collected. And whether it's, you know, the increasing dependence on FPOS and, you know, how many people pay with cash these days, it's all PayWave, etc. All of that is digitized. All of that's being collected. One assumes that the bank don't sell this information to people who want to sell me shoes. But if they know I have certain spending habits and profiles, I mean, if you're shopping online, you will get that. You know, Amazon seemed to know I'm on a trip to New Zealand, so they're offering me, you know, rugby shirts. For argument, how the hell did they know that? You know, okay, I booked the trip there, and there was a cookie in my browser. That's why they sort of, you know, using this information to provide me targeted information, which they'd say is improving my experience. But at the same time, it's actually, well, now you just know I've just booked a trip to New Zealand. And I didn't want you to know that especially, but I didn't realize I have to go incognito mode or delete my browser every time I go to a different page, etc. So there's a range of things like this, which I'm a professor of computing, I kind of living in that world. But there are many people who are completely unaware of, you know, that the thing in your pocket is like an Orwellian nightmare, your mobile phone. You're always on, you're always tracked. We know where you are, when you were, what you do with it. And this is something that people just, you know, just assume it's, there's no issue. But actually, if you wanted to use it for bad reasons, or if the government wanted to track people down, they have the perfect device for doing it. you know, we know. So there's a lot of work I do with data journalists at the University of Melbourne, where they deal with the practical realities of, you know, the WikiLeaks and things of this nature. And this kind of, these devices are, can, if you get on the wrong side of the tracks with government, then they can use a lot of the technology around them to do what they want, basically, which is in national interests. So
would you say that the degree of private or personal information that's out there, is that one of the risks? What would you say are the risks of this sort of new data landscape?
Well, there's all sorts. I mean, the fact that I can find out who went to the sexy kitten club in St Kilda is a risk. You know, if I wanted to blackmail that person, you know, I wouldn't, obviously, but there's a lot of information that is kind of need to know, and people shouldn't have access to that. You know, it shouldn't be allowed, or it shouldn't be as easy as it is right now. And there are many other data sets which are, you can sort of see, yes, there is a, I mean, if I think of the world of the data that's just being collected around us now, it's a bit of cowboy land. Everything is happening, and people probably are not aware of how easy it is to integrate data to tell stories, to, you know, for whatever reason. If you think about the medical land, it's like clinical sort of dealing with patients, then there's a different story. For me to access data from a hospital, I have to go through many, many steps, many processes. So we have to have ethics. We have to get consent from the patients. We have to be able to ensure that all our security meets all the standards, and you should never be able to re-identify an individual. So they've got some very structured information about how you go about accessing and using the data. Where in many other places, it's just, there is no. I mean, I have to have ethics permission to use social media data when Twitter and LinkedIn and everybody else is just using this to make money, basically. So I think what I generally do is I try to raise awareness. When I teach cloud computing, and one of my lectures is I always give about the downsides, the dark side of what you can do with this. And so that, you know, the sex industry was one example, but there are many others where you can use data to identify individuals and their habits and where they go and what they do, and which you shouldn't be allowed to. You know, we can identify if a house is empty. So we're actually doing some work right now with ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, because on census night, they send people around to identify, you know, have you, you know, filled in census form, etc. And right now they just have a bunch of people going around cold calling, tapping on doors and hoping that someone's in. But what you can do is you can run, you know, develop software using social media, for example, which says the likelihood of the house being occupied or not is 16% or 26% based upon the profile of social media use in the building. And so we can do a lot of these things now. We've done a whole variety of work looking at how many people live in a skyscraper. You know, the way they measure that right now is by just looking at the water use. If they use, I have a bath a day, you have a bath a week, you know, that's a really poor measure. But they have no idea if it's a one-bedroom apartment with 16 students, or if it's some foreign investor who's bought a property and it's not being occupied, but they're just putting their money into the real estate. So there's lots of things like this which you can do. But it's, as I say, there are very sort of diverse uses of data that people have never really grasped what you can do with this if you know how. And I guess this is part of the challenge, I guess, of where I fit.
And the other challenge, it seems to me, again going back to one of your earlier answers, is this the business case for government, sure, to keep investing in mm-hmm. The technology, sure, and making the data accessible, because it's an ongoing project. Mm-hmm. So what's the case for a policymaker to keep on?
I guess they generally speaking, most projects I'm involved in, there is a range of, you write a grant, you get the grant, and then you have a range of deliverables and milestones and things you're supposed to meet. And if it's a big grant, then you'll have a range of key performance indicators, assessing impact of the market, etc. And so there's a range of factors that can influence what government might want to achieve. It could be we want 300 papers per year in publications. It could be we want the public to think favorably of what you're doing. We want 10 articles on the ABC News website per year based upon what we're funding here. Make an impact, get the people aware. So there's a very broad array of what the government invest in and what they're trying to achieve through that. So it's not a simple answer as, okay, they, if you give them this, you know, this is the solution and this, they'd be happy with this one. And I guess the agencies themselves have their own agendas. So if you're dealing with Vic Roads or the EPA or the Department of Health, whoever it might be, they have their own. We do the following. And sometimes that is, okay, well, we don't have the skill sets in-house to do that kind of analysis, so we can't process all this data or link it with other data. So they all sponsor, you know, folks like myself to build stuff for them. But it's very, very broad. But I would say in terms of why would you, if I was a government, if I was the Department of X, why would I care about this? I would care about it because if I'm not caring about it, I'm becoming obsolete. And this is the danger. So there's many agencies who know they have to upgrade. They have to be involved in the next wave of expectations. So if your website doesn't work perfectly on a mobile phone, then you know most people don't log in through a laptop these days. It's supposed to be always on, always accessible, easy to use, etc. And so it's more than just, you know, we collect data and it's on our website. If you know how to find it, there's technologies which are now becoming available, which is changes the way we analyze and access and use data and interpret data and digest data. And so I think anyone who's not embracing that right now is at risk as an organization. You will soon be found out when the public say, we want to access this, and you have no capabilities to produce that kind of data because you're dealing with a Windows-based system from 10 years ago, and it just can't do it. You have to think about how do we do the kind of things which people want now and people want in the future. And each agency will have their own vision of what that is. There isn't a single solution for all. But there's certainly technologies which we've worked with which seem to tackle many of the issues of what many agencies are wrestling with, whether it's data in hospitals or whether it's data on roads. If you try to do a real-time visualization of every car in Victoria right now, Vic Roads would struggle to do that. If you give us the data, we could do it because we have access to thousands of servers on the cloud and we can do those kind of visualizations because we've sort of gone through the technical sort of solutions about how to do that. How do you feed data into 1,000 servers concurrently and process it and index it and visualize it, etc. And this is where research fits and drives forward. And the agencies are looking at what we're doing and how could we work with them so that they can tap into some of this expertise. And it's very broad. As I say, there are many areas where you could say. I'll give you one example that we're working on now as well with Vic Roads is intelligent sort of traffic monitoring. So if you're driving along the road and that says 80 kilometers an hour, that's the speed limit. It could go to 60 if there was dangers ahead or queues ahead. It could go to 90 or 100 if there was none. How do they make that decision? They have a range of monitors they're capturing, and then generally someone in the HQ is setting that road sign. You could actually use data collected in real time at the side of the road to inform and guide the speed limits so that if you drive at the speed limit, you should not get caught at a red light. In other countries, they do this. I lived in Germany. There were certain areas where if you drive on the road and you're within the speed limit, you don't have to get caught at red lights. It's just they've coordinated traffic signals, basically. That doesn't seem to happen a lot here, but it could, it should. I mean, it's an obvious if you want to have improved sort of, if Melbourne is to be the most livable city, then you'd like to think that those things were available, but right now it's not. So I'm rambling again.
Well, I'll just ask one more question, which is about, data democracy. What do you think of, how would you define, do you define it? How do you define it?
It means different things to different people, I guess. So there's one hand, everyone, all data should be open and accessible. That's kind of unrealistic. I mean, there are many data sets that people shouldn't have access to, health data, personal information, etc. There are certainly areas where there is room for improvement in increasing the, not so much the openness, but the accessibility of data. I guess that's another way to describe it. So sticking data on a website in a bunch of web links is not really helping. It can give some people, if they really want to go there and download each one individually, but we need better ways for it to advertise, to access, to use. And there's one thing I haven't really spoken about here, which is all of this assumes it's all open. And more often than not, it's not. I mean, most researchers I work with, they openness is kind of not really what they are. It's never possible. So they're dealing with data which is sensitive. It's sensitive from a variety of perspectives. So when I started on one of my larger projects, which was required to interface to all of the government agencies about the urban settlements and cities in Australia, I was building a security system which spoke to the ABS, or one that spoke to Geoscience Australia, and one that spoke to Vic Roads. All these different agencies have data. And this system was not designed saying, give me a copy of your data, I'll just keep it here and then people can access it. It was very much designed about, we speak to all of these remote providers. So when you get more data, we can get that up-to-date data. So we're always fresh and we're always live. And so we built that system and it works. It's being used heavily now. There was one challenge in that, which is the security aspects. So most people, there are many data sets, let's say the housing data, commercial data, which is only accessible to certain people, or the tax data from the Australian Business Registry, how much tax does a given company make and how many employees do they have in certain areas. There are data sets with degrees of sensitivity and security and that is required. So we've built lots of technologies to do this, and we have a system that's live and that's being used heavily, I guess. So, but one of the challenges is, when I first started this conversation with different government agencies about, I need to access your data, what security standards do you adhere to, because I need to speak a certain protocol to access your data. And everyone has their own way of doing it. And this was, at the time I didn't realize this, I was in 2010, I came and I thought, okay, I'd done a lot of work previously in the UK with the NHS and linking health data with many government agencies. But when I came to Australia, I just assumed there must be someone who's responsible for security in GovLand, whether it's Vic.gov or, you know, the federal government. And the upshot of all of this is I found out, A, there's no one responsible. And then I was contacted by the Defence Signals Directorate saying, who are you and why are you asking questions about our security systems? You know, as though I'm some sort of, you know, trying to socially engineer and hack into their systems. But this is probably one of the problems, I guess. So it's not just about access to the data. Having the accepted standards for how to access data securely. And that's really one of the issues right now. So there's one thing, having a service I can talk to, which will allow me access to your data. And so we have many flavors of doing that. But there's another, which is, how do I securely connect to that service where not everyone in the whole world can access it now? So we do a lot of work in that space. And that's, if the data landscape, the open data landscape, is a patchwork quilt, the secure access to data is a string vest, I guess you could say. It's much more fragmented about how to do this, and it means different things to different organizations about, I mean, we've done many things in that space. I give you one final anecdote, which is, did work with Vic Health in Victoria, where they have data of 25,000 Victorians. Every couple of years, they fill in a survey, do you drink, do you smoke, all this kind of stuff. And that survey includes where these people live. So they know they live at number one, High Street, number 17, wherever it might be. And so typically what they do is they aggregate the 300 people who live in that suburb, and then they release that information, like 27% of the people drink a bottle of wine a night, or things like aggregate statistics. The researchers I was working with wanted to know, what's the correlation between people who drink a certain amount and where you can buy alcohol? So if you have a Dan Murphy's on your corner, you might be more likely to drink. Or, you know, do you gamble? Where are the pokie machines? Or do you exercise? Where are the parks? But some notion of physical location, which could be used to aggregate the data. So the average person in Carlton drinks so much, and by the way, they live 500 meters from a bottle shop. So to do that, we had to use the unit level data. We had to build algorithms that could measure along the roads how you would get to that bottle shop and how far away it might be. But Vic Health wouldn't open the firewall for us, so we couldn't just ping it. So we had to write software where the firewall was closed, but we still managed to pull in things from their side. So there are many, many ways and many, many recipes for building secure systems. And I've never yet had a system that we couldn't build from a technical perspective that did what was required. But it's working with they would never have gotten that far with Vic Health if they hadn't trusted me, they hadn't seen what I've done previously, if they hadn't been willing to work with us on, because this was something that they were interested in themselves, the kind of spatial analytics you can get from analyzing their data in ways they hadn't thought possible, or, you know, we have access to where are the pokey machines, or where are the bottle shops, or where are the bus stops, and what's your average commute, things like this. And this is something where that was they benefited too. And I guess that's kind of at the heart of a lot of this. There has to be more than give me your data, your government, I need access to your data. Ideally, that should be a reciprocal, you know, there should be some mutual benefit from this. I can do things with that data that you will benefit from by allowing me access. And sometimes it's quite hard to have that conversation because unless you have access to the data, you kind of don't know what you can do with it and how you can benefit them. And this is something where it takes time. It takes many, many meetings and many discussions about what we could do, how we could do it, how would we do it. And it takes several years to allow those kind of technical solutions to be put into place. But it can be done, and we've done it several times, many times. But security is the killer app, I guess, for the big data space. So looking at open data, many people I work with who are interested in open data, they don't really care about, you know, how I'm accessing that data. If they can get that off the website, they'll just do it. They can do that themselves. A lot of the time they can do this. But more often than not, it's the data they can't get access to where they need me. So we have many data sets where they are the by far the most used data sets is the ones that they can't get access to, either without paying or without a lot of pain in terms of negotiations with the data agencies that have the data.
Fantastic. Anything else that occurred to you or when you were on the way on the train that you thought, I really must say this thing and this topic?
Not really. I mean, I guess there's one other dimension to this is that a lot of the time people think that they are just there's a perspective that open data is government has data or industry has data and researchers and public want data and therefore give me. There's a lot of my work now which is collecting data from people and putting it into the systems. So we do an awful lot of work with mobile technology, mobile apps, which are targeted to meet the needs of many different communities. But a good example is if you're a cancer patient, you might want to be able to report on how you're progressing with your condition. So the way it typically works in most hospitals is a patient is seen every 3-4 months and then they get some diagnosis, some treatments, and then they see you later on. But capturing real-time information on this and on the patients, or even games. We've built a lot of mobile app games for children, so with rare conditions. So one of them is called Niemann-Pick, which is it's the nastiest disease. It's a neurological disease where the children become deaf, blind, immobile, and then they die before they become teenagers. It's a horrible condition. But we've built mobile apps for them to play games because they have problems with their motor control, so they can't control their hands. And so generally, this is a very rare condition, thankfully. But building technology which they can play a game and you can measure how good are they today? You know, can they complete level 3 of whatever it might be? So there's a lot of work going on and not just people consuming data, but people targeted applications for people to, you know, Joe Public to contribute data. And then once you have the data, you can benchmark it. You can do all kinds of things with it. You can then say, okay, the average child with this condition should be on 6 milligrams of miglustatin and not 24 as we thought we should be, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a range of these kinds of other possibilities where humans are, if you like, a sensor. They can provide information in an ethically sound and trusted way. So we have ways to build these technologies now where anyone can download the app from the App Store, but you need the special code to activate it, which then ties it to you in the database. So we do a lot of work in that space too, and that's something which is many people are interested in.
This it's kind of ties into that citizen science community monitoring as well, isn't it? Those amazing examples of astrology, the world is counting the stars and.
Sure. So that's another example where I mean, every day my commute is on a scooter, and I have a gadget I wear around my neck which measures my own personal pollution exposure. It's synchronized with my phone, and then at the end of my trip, I enter it into a database. So you could say, well, whose job is it to measure the air pollution in Melbourne or wherever? So we have the EPA or the OEH in New South Wales, and they have a bunch of locations, one in Box Hill, one in Aspendale, one in Footscray, where they measure pollution, and they measure it very accurately. But they have no idea, you know, what's the pollution like here today? No one's measuring it outside. But so there's a lot of activity and effort in getting citizens to collect this. And there's lots of interest in, especially in certain areas like Port Melbourne, where there's lots of articulated lorries going past schools, etc., where the parents are worried about the, you know, the diesel and the effect on the children. Even through to policies looking at parents doing the school drop-off run should not park the car idling, because it's, you know, you have, as soon as, one of the things I've seen is that when I do my commutes, you have spikes in the data when your pollution increases if you're at a traffic light. So again, this is the idea of if you had the coordinated traffic light system, there shouldn't be pollution. But when you're stationary, you're still running, you're collecting pollution, and this is exacerbated around schools as well. But again, people need to be aware of this, need to have, you know, understand this, and then ideally change policy based upon that. But it's complicated because there are many gadgets out there that can do this, and there's many people who have no idea what's possible and how easy it is to do. And again, part of our work is to show if everyone collected this data, we could process it. We can link that kind of pollution with the number of cars on the roads, with number of people who have pulmonary disorders, and then start looking at the correlations of all these heterogeneous data sets. And it's possible. Technically, we've done it. We're doing it now. We have PhDs working on the exact topic in terms of the IT side and these algorithms. But it's kind of how then we roll it out for everyone to start, you know, engaging in this. So it'll come, I'm sure. But right now it's still building some of the tech which can integrate diverse data sets is kind of still what many people are asking for right now, as opposed to everyone in Melbourne should have one of these gadgets and measure pollution. Or we could put them on the trams or the trains. There could be a range of, you know, other solutions for doing it. And I know Vic Roads and others are currently putting pollution monitors on the street network, so on the lights, so they can measure pollution as yet another data set where they can see what happens if everyone drove with a Tesla or with a Prius or something, or if we only allowed certain cars to drive on certain roads at, you know, particular days of the week.